But I don't think you're the type of person who could simply walk up to another human being, put a gun to his head, and pull the trigger. Have you considered removing your son from harm's way until you can effect some type of resolution to this extremely unusual situation? I hated it when Richie went into his lawyer-speak mode. I much preferred plain, simple English. Effect some type of resolution? I said. What the hell does that even mean, Richie?
I might not have phrased that exactly the way I intended, he said. What I meant was that perhaps the authorities will soon get a line on Mr. Jordan, especially now that you've gone to the patrol officer and expressed your concerns about the stop. I would expect the officer you spoke with to get a hold of the FBI agent immediately and tell him that there's a good possibility they might lose whatever evidence was in the van. I would expect the officer to tell the FBI agent they need to find a different way to get to Mr. Jordan, and they need to do it quickly. I would think they would set up surveillance on him and wait until he makes a mistake.
They'll also start talking to his family and friends if he has any, I said. And as soon as they do, Jordan will find out about it and Sean will be dead.
And that's precisely why you moved the boy out of harm's way.
Where? I said. Where do I take him? Do I give up my practice and run away with Sean until Jalen Jordan is arrested for killing another child? And, by the way, how do I live with the guilt of knowing I allowed a little boy to be killed without doing anything about it? Do I put my entire life on hold because this sicko threatened to hurt Sean? You know I'm not wired like that, Richie.
Let me give it some more thought and call me this evening, he said. In the meantime, don't kill anybody.
Chapter 6. As I drove west along I-40 toward the Farragut exit, I wondered about something Richie Fells had said.
I've never taken you for a killer. A bit intense and unpredictable at times, perhaps. Emotionally unstable occasionally, but I don't think you're the type of person who could simply walk up to another human being, put a gun to his head, and pull the trigger.
What he'd said about me being intense and unpredictable at times, perhaps emotionally unstable, was true. He just didn't know how true, because he'd never seen me fight anywhere outside of a courtroom. Richie hadn't seen me on the football field. He hadn't seen me wrestle, and he hadn't seen me in a mixed martial arts competition. He also didn't see what I did to my father. It was 19 years earlier, a cold, bleak night in November, the day before Thanksgiving. I was 13 and going through the early stages of puberty. I put on some muscle weight, had grown a few inches, and my voice was changing. I'd also joined the wrestling team at school and had excelled at the sport. I'd grown up fighting, mostly because of my size. I was smaller than a lot of guys, which meant they thought they could pick on me. They found out very quickly that I would fight back. My maternal grandfather, Delmar Royston, was a small, lithe man. He was a machinist during the week and an outdoorsman on the weekends until an aneurysm dropped him in his tracks when I was 6 years old. I remember him vividly, though, and I remember him telling me during a camping trip right before I started school,
"Darren, buddy, it's just human nature. The boys bigger than you are going to try to dominate you. They're going to try to make you do things they want you to do. They'll try to push you around. You can't let them, son. If you do, you'll spend your whole life mad at the world. First one that picks on you, punch him square in the nose. That'll discourage about 90% of the rest of them right there."
On that day before Thanksgiving, it was just me and my mom and my father. I was nervous. I was always nervous during the holidays because I knew, just as my mother knew, what the holidays could bring. There would be angst, if not outright terror, along with drunkenness and perhaps violence. My father, Billy Street, was a drunk. He started drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon at noon every day, and he drank until he passed out sometime between 9 o'clock and midnight. He'd been doing it for as long as I could remember. Billy tried to act like he owned a mechanics business. He worked on cars in a run-down shop out back of our house, but all he really cared about was making enough money to drink. I remember one night when I was very young, maybe 3 or 4, when my Uncle Tommy walked into the house while my father was hitting my mother. Uncle Tommy beat him unconscious, and for several years, the violence stopped. The threats remained, but the violence stopped. Then Tommy went to prison, and it didn't take long for Billy to start up again. Most nights, Billy would sit in the den in front of the television in an alcohol-induced haze and mumble to himself about whatever was troubling him at the moment. Some nights he would cry, but other nights, especially if he managed to get his hands on some liquor or some drugs, he became violent. He enjoyed removing his belt and lashing us with it. He struck me dozens of times with that belt, sometimes with the buckle, for offenses so minuscule that I rarely knew why I was being beaten. He beat my mother viciously. The beatings always came with threats of death should anyone dare to tell the police or anyone at school, or anyone at all for that matter, and were always followed by remorseful wailing and pleas to God for forgiveness. It was a sickening way to live. I remember asking my mother repeatedly why she allowed him to get away with the things he did. Her answer was always some variant of, "He doesn't mean it, Darren," or, "It's really my fault, honey," followed by a vague reference to Jesus and how divine it is to forgive. On that cold evening in November, my mother had closed her salon early to make a run to the grocery store, so everything would be perfect for Billy on Thanksgiving. I'd spent a couple of hours with two of my friends that afternoon, but I'd asked them for a ride home early so I'd be around for the evening meal. I knew we would be the only people at our house over the holiday weekend. Billy had long ago worn out his welcome with the few remaining family members, and none of them would dare set foot in our house because they knew he would be deep in the bottle. Thanksgiving meant a wild turkey weekend for Billy, and he'd started taking shots of wild turkey chased by his beer as soon as the sun had gone down around 5 o'clock that Wednesday afternoon. By 7 o'clock, when the three of us sat down for supper, he was spoiling for a fight, and so was I. I'd noticed the telltale signs over the past week. The escalation and the insults directed toward both my mother and me. The constant threats of violence. The suggestions that the world would be a better place if both of us were dead. And I'd readied myself mentally for the inevitable as best I could. My father wasn't a big man, nor was he especially strong. He'd spent 15 years poisoning himself with alcohol, and at the moment, he was full-on drunk. I didn't know whether I could take him in a physical confrontation, but I was determined to try if I had to. "Monsieur shit," he slurred at my mother as she bowed her head and thanked the Lord for her family and the meal. I stiffened when he said it. The tone in his voice was familiar. It told me something bad was about to happen. The muscles in my thighs began to twitch. "What's what?" my mother said. A fake smile crossed her face, and I could see fear in her eyes. "This shit, right here," Billy said, pointing to his plate. "You know what it is," Mom said, trying to maintain the smile. "Don't get smart with me, bitch," Billy said. "I asked you a question." "It's spaghetti," Mom said. "We have spaghetti the night before Thanksgiving every year because that's what you always want. The sauce is your mother's recipe. You love it."
"Bullshit," Billy said. "I ain't no fucking guinea."
"I don't think anyone here is suggesting you're Italian, Billy," Mom said. "It's just that for as long as I can remember, you've always wanted..." My fists clenched as I watched Billy pick up a fistful of spaghetti from his plate and throw it into my mother's face.
"Trying to feed me wop food day before a holy day," Billy said. "Fuck's the matter with you anyway?"
"I'm sorry," Mom said as she reached for a paper towel and began wiping spaghetti sauce from her cheek. "I thought you..."
"Thought wrong, didn't you, bitch? Matter of fact, you ain't ever thought right in your whole life. Trapping me into this marriage the way you did, having this damn kid..."
I saw his hand reach below the table and knew he was undoing his belt buckle. He was drunk, so it took him a few seconds, long enough for me to get up from the table, grab the metal baseball bat I'd stashed behind the refrigerator a couple of days earlier, and stand between him and Mom.
"No," I said. "You're not going to hit her. You're never going to hit her or me again."
He stood shakily and freed the belt from the loops around his waist.
"Well, looky here," he mumbled. "Got us a hero in the house."
He raised the belt above his head, but before he could swing it, I hit him in the ribcage with the bat as hard as I could. I heard a bone break, heard the breath rush out of his body, and the next thing I knew, he was on the floor by the table. He sat upright for a couple of seconds until I kicked him square in the chin and sent him straight over onto his back. His head thumped against the floor, and he was still. I jerked the belt out of his right hand, tossed the bat aside, and for the next minute or two, I beat him with the belt while my mother watched me in silence from across the room. I beat his head and face with the strap for a good while, and then I took the strap in my hand and beat his torso and arms and legs with the buckle. After he finally managed to roll into a ball to try to protect himself, I straddled him and pounded him in the head with my fists. Years of anger, hatred, frustration, and vengeance came pouring out of me. When I finally stood up, breathing heavily, I looked over at my mother. She was standing against the refrigerator door with her arms folded and a look of resignation on her face.
"Just get him out of here, Darren," she said.
I dragged him by the ankles through the house, out the front door, and down the porch steps into the yard. It was cold and dark, the only light coming from the front porch. He was lying on his back, looking up at me through swollen eyes as puffs of mist rose from his bloody lips. "You don't live here anymore," I said as I knelt beside him. "Do you hear me? Do you understand me, Billy? You don't live here anymore. Go to your druggy girlfriend's house, go to your sister's, go to hell for all I care. But if you come back here, I'm going to kill you. I mean it. You set foot on this property again, and I'll kill you." My cell phone rang, and it jolted me back to the present. I looked at the screen, saw it was my mother, and answered it.
"This man who threatened Sean, what was he driving?"
she said. "I don't know. He was driving a van a couple of days ago, but the police impounded it. Why?"
"I think somebody might be watching us."
"Watching? What do you mean? Is somebody parked close?"
"I've had this feeling ever since I picked Sean up," she said. "I don't know how to describe it, just eerie, you know? Like someone was following me. I kept looking in the rear view and didn't notice anybody, but there's so much traffic coming out this way, I probably wouldn't be able to pick anybody out, even if they were following me. But I've been sitting in the living room looking out the window at the road, and this car keeps going by. It just went past again."
"Are you sure? What kind of car?"
"I don't know, Darren. I don't know cars, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm scared. Are you close?"
"Yeah, just 2 or 3 minutes."
"Hurry."
"Which way was the car going?"
"Toward the interstate."
"Then it's coming toward me. Can you tell me anything about it?"
"A small car. Light blue, I think."
"Is that it?"
"I don't know cars, Darren."
There was still plenty of light left, so I started watching the cars in the oncoming lane. About a minute after Mom and I talked, I saw a light blue coupe coming toward me. It passed quickly, but I got a clear look at the driver, a male with dark, long hair and wearing glasses. It was Jalen Jordan. Chapter 7. My mother's first name was Shirley. She'd changed her last name back to Royston when she divorced Billy Street. She lived in a neat, fastidiously clean white house that sat on 7 acres, about 5 miles from Farragut High School in Knoxville. I was going so fast when I pulled into her driveway that I dug up some of her immaculately manicured lawn and slid off into the yard. I parked outside the garage and dialed my paralegal's cell number. "Rachel," I said, "did Jalen Jordan list a cell number and an address on the intake form?" Every potential client who came into the office filled out an intake form that listed basic contact information.
"Just a sec," Rachel said.
She came back on the line shortly thereafter and said,
"He did."
"Give them to me." As soon as I had Jordan's cell number, I dialed it. To my surprise, a male voice answered. "Is this Jalen Jordan?" I said.
"You sound like Darren Street,"
he said. "What the hell do you think you're doing?"
"Whatever do you mean, counselor?"
"I just passed you on the road," I said. "You followed my mom, and now you're driving back and forth, just like you did the other night."
"So, your mom lives in that white house?" "I thought so."
"Stay away from my family."
"I haven't bothered anyone in your family. I just wanted to show you I was serious about what I said this afternoon. And I think I'm doing a pretty good job of it so far. I figured you'd call your wife and have her get Sean out of school. But I guess she was busy or you couldn't get a hold of her. Am I right? I was at the school before your mom was. I watched her lead little Sean out the front door, and then I followed her out here.
I'm not going to represent you. Just leave us alone.
Yes, you are. And like I said at your office, you need to do right by me.
I'm not going to help you kill children.
I don't know where you got the idea that I wanted you to help me kill anyone. I'm not asking you to help me do anything. All I'm asking is that you do what lawyers get paid to do. I want my constitutional rights upheld. Those police officers violated my rights, and your job is to hold them accountable for it.
You're delusional, I said. The underwear the cops found in the van is going to be tested. And when the tests come back and show that the underwear belonged to the two boys who were murdered, you're going to be arrested and held without bail. And under those circumstances, there isn't a judge on the planet who will rule that your van was illegally stopped and searched and suppress whatever evidence they found in it, including the underwear. The cops will come into court and lie, and the judge will accept everything they say as gospel. You can't win this. You're going to prison for the rest of your life if they don't give you the death penalty.
You spoke to the police officers, didn't you?
I talked to one of them.
The man or the woman?
The woman.
What did you tell her?
I didn't tell her anything. I just asked her about the stop.
And did she tell you the truth? Did she tell you they violated my rights?
It doesn't matter, I yelled. Are you listening to me? It doesn't matter. They'll perjure themselves if it means bringing a child killer to justice. You're going to prison.
That's bad news for your little boy,
he said. You sick son of a bitch. I'll cut your head off if you come anywhere near Sean.
You're right about my mother being a bitch,
Jordan said in that smug accent.
I really can't stand her. And did you see that hair? She looks like she's wearing a dead fox on her head. Now, as far as your family, I really won't get any pleasure out of killing your wife or your mother, so I'll probably leave them alone. But the boy is another matter. I'll get to him eventually. I'm sure I'll have to get out of here for a little while, but I'll cruise back through someday in the not-too-distant future and find a way to snatch little Sean up. He and I will get to know each other on an intimate basis, and then I'll strangle him and throw him into a river like a piece of garbage.
My heart was beating hard against my chest, and my vision had tunneled. I started to yell another threat into the phone, but it had gone silent. Jalen Jordan was gone. Chapter 8. I climbed out of the car and walked quickly around the house and in through the back door. Mom was waiting for me in the kitchen. Sean, who had his mother's sandy brown hair and robin egg blue eyes, was standing right beside her. Hey, big guy, I said as I walked across the kitchen and picked him up. I was probably over-involved in Sean's life, but I was unapologetic about it. After what I'd been through with my father, I suppose it was natural. I spent as much time with him as possible. I took him camping 3 or 4 times a year during the summer and fall. I took him to soccer or to basketball or to t-ball practices and games. I took him to movies and we went fishing and I played video games with him. I enjoyed cooking for him and sharing meals with him. I spent far more time with him than I did with my wife, and I enjoyed every second of it.
What are we doing here, Dad?
Sean said.
Grandma says everything is okay, but she never picks me up from school, and Mom isn't here. And I was wondering why we came here in the middle of the day, because we don't ever come here except on Saturday or Sunday, and today's Tuesday, so I was wondering.
Sean was a smart little guy, and he was a talker. He'd always been a talker. I'd take him to movies, and he'd ask questions and make commentary from preview to closing credits. He was so distracting in the car that I had removed the middle bench seat from our minivan so Sean would have to talk from the back. It hadn't stopped him, though. It hadn't even slowed him. He just talked louder. I thought we might take a trip to Pigeon Forge for a couple of days, I said. Stay in one of those chalets in the mountains. We'll go to the aquarium and find some other fun stuff to do. How's that sound to you?
What about school? You know they don't like for us kids to miss school because they say we get behind and then we might not be able to catch up, and
it's okay, Sean. I'll talk to them. Don't worry about it. A couple of days off from school never hurt anybody.
Is Grandma going to go with us?
Sure, why not?
What about Mom?
She's working right now, but I told her to meet us tonight. Listen, why don't you go in the den and play some Mario? Your grandma and I need to talk. It was him, I said as soon as Sean got settled on the couch and was lost in the video game. I saw him. The same guy that was at the office. He followed you here.
I knew it,
Mom said. She was sturdy and still pretty at 56. Her chestnut hair was long, thick, and starting to gray. Her green eyes filled with worry.
Is he insane?
I don't think so, which makes him even more dangerous. We need to get out of here, find a good place to hide, and let me figure out what to do. Can your girls handle the shop for a couple of days?
Don't worry about the shop. What about Katie?
I don't think she'll even bother to come, I said. I haven't said much about it, but things aren't all that great between us right now.
Things have never been great between you. I'm not blind or deaf.
I shrugged my shoulders. We'll talk about Katie later, I said. For now, pack enough for a couple of days. You drive your car and I'll drive the van. You lead the way. Sean can ride with me since I have more experience dealing with all the questions that are going to come. Let's drive down to Maryville and then back to Pigeon Forge. Make a lot of turns, pull into gas stations, double back a lot. I'll tell Sean we're playing a game.
He'll know you're lying.
I know.
Why don't you call the police?
Mom said. And tell them what? That Jordan threatened my son? There's no real crime there, Mom. They can't do anything about it. Besides, the boys who were killed are being handled by the FBI. It's their case.
You could ask them to keep an eye on him.
You know as well as I do, they're not going to keep an eye on somebody just because some lawyer asks them to. They'd laugh me out of the place.
Tell them he's the man who killed those boys.
I could lose my law license if I do that.
That's crazy, Darren. That's absolutely crazy. What do you plan to do when we get to Pigeon Forge?
Let's do what I told Sean. Let's check into a chalet. There's a guy that lives in the mountains close to Gatlinburg I want to go see.
Who is he?
Former client. He might be just what the doctor ordered. Chapter 9. James Tipton lived in a rundown trailer on the side of a mountain about 6 miles from the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Gatlinburg. I'd been to his place once before, back when he insisted that I come out and share a victory drink of his personal stash of homemade moonshine after I'd gotten him acquitted in a jury trial for slicing a man so badly that 200 stitches had been required to close the knife wounds. The man had repeatedly run his truck into the back of James's car while James was driving down the road with the man's girlfriend in the passenger seat. James claimed he didn't know the woman had a live-in boyfriend, and she was such a miserable witness that the jury believed James and bought my argument of self-defense. Not that they shouldn't have bought it. It was self-defense. The guy bashed James's car 4 or 5 times, and then when James pulled over and got out, the guy tried to fight him. The prosecution thought the knife wounds were excessive for a case of self-defense, and maybe they were. But was it James's fault that he was an excellent knife fighter and just happened to have a knife in the car with him? The jury was basically faced with making a choice between 2 pretty unsavory people, James and the victim. They chose James. One of the things I was able to tell the jury about James was that he'd never been convicted of anything. As a matter of fact, he'd never even been arrested. But I'd heard from several people, cops, other lawyers, and clients, that James was a genuine badass. He came from a long line of criminals that began with moonshiners and bootleggers and had graduated to running drugs. James had apparently become territorial about it. A Sevier County detective told me that they suspected James of committing 2 murders. A couple of brothers who had gotten into the oxycodone trade and reportedly crossed James. But they hadn't been able to put together a solid case. The men were found in a barn on their parents' property. They'd both been skinned after their throats were cut. It was just after dark by the time I got Sean and Mom settled into a chalet and drove to James's place. His trailer was brown and seemed to list to the right where the slope dropped off sharply and steeply. There was a black pit bull chained to a metal spike just to the left of the front stoop, and the driveway had been paved with flattened beer cans, a little trick I'd seen a couple of times before and had always referred to as redneck asphalt. There were also hundreds of skulls around the place, cattle and deer skulls mostly, with a few bear and cat skulls mixed in, along with dozens of sets of antlers. It gave the place a sort of gothic, medieval, venture-forth-at-your-own-peril vibe. There was a dual-axle pickup in the driveway, along with an old Dodge Charger, and I could see a Harley-Davidson motorcycle underneath a crumbling outbuilding. The dog went nuts when I pulled up, and within seconds, I saw James's slim frame appear on the stoop. It was just before dark, but I noticed the outline of a large pistol in his right hand. I got out of the car and said, "James! It's me, Darren Street!" He stuck the hand cannon into the waist of the blue jeans he was wearing and hurried down the stoop. I could see him grinning widely as he approached my car. James was a few years older than me, mid-30s, a few inches taller than me at 6 feet, and had short black hair that was receding just a little. He wore a pencil-thin mustache that must have required a great deal of attention. He also had beautiful teeth, something that seemed out of place in his surroundings. He was shirtless, well-muscled, and covered in tattoos.
"Well, I'll be damned," he said as he approached and stuck out his hand. "How the hell are you, counselor?"
I took the offered hand and smiled back at him. "I'm good, James. You?"
"Shut up, Zeus!"
he yelled at the dog.
"I can't complain," he said as he turned back to me. "Come on in the house and take a load off."
"Is anybody here besides you?"
"Granny's inside," he said. "But she's about to leave."
Luann Granny Tipton was probably in her early 70s. She had attended every meeting James and I had had before his trial, and she had been in the courtroom during the trial and when the verdict was read. She was also at the after party, drinking moonshine and dancing to bluegrass music right along with the rest of the Tipton clan. The Tiptons were a rough bunch, and I learned quickly that Granny was their undisputed matriarch. There were three boys, Ronnie, Eugene, and James, all of whom she claimed as her grandchildren, although I found out later that James really wasn't a biological grandchild. Granny, Ronnie, and Eugene lived about a half mile farther up the mountain. Granny lived in a nice home, and the boys lived in beautiful cabins on either side of her. James was a self-described black sheep, and the trailer and his skulls seemed to confirm the image. "It'll be nice to see her again," I said. "How's it been going?"
"Had me a live-in woman for a couple of weeks," James said. "But I kept going out to the bars and bringing other women home with me. She had some problems putting up with it."
"Imagine that," I said.
"Hell, counselor, it wasn't like I was ignoring her. I always offered to let her join the party. She just wasn't into threesomes."
James was probably a sociopath, but he was a likable sociopath. He had a loud, infectious laugh, and it rose over the barking of the dog and bounced off the surrounding slopes. We walked up the three stairs onto the stoop and stepped into the trailer, which was just as I'd remembered it, remarkably clean and well-kept. He led me to the small kitchen, where I sat down at a formica-top table. Granny walked in from the other end of the trailer.
"Well, as I live and breathe," she said as I stood to hug her, "Darren Street in the flesh. What brings you up this way?"
"Hi, Granny," I said. Back when I was representing James, she insisted that I call her Granny. "I had a little break at the office, so I thought I'd bring my boy to Gatlinburg for a day or two. Just thought I'd drop in and say hello."
"Well, it's good to see you," she said, "but I have to get going. It's bingo night at the Moose Lodge, and my friends will be expecting me."
I said goodbye, and James and I stood on the front porch as she walked out, climbed into the dual-axle pickup, and fired it up.
"Feisty as ever," James said as she drove out of the driveway. "I'll have to take you back up to her place one of these days. Get you some of that ham and bacon she cures. She really likes you."
"The feeling's mutual."
"Let's go on back inside," James said.
He stood over me after I sat down at the table, and I noticed beads of sweat on his forehead. He was scratching his arms, too. "You all right?" I said. "You sick?"
"What, me? I'm fine, counselor. Good as gold, right as rain. What can I get you? I got beer, tequila, vodka. Well, I got some of that homemade corn whiskey that you liked in the freezer. Got some killer weed, too, if you're interested. Probably some other stuff if you want."
"No drugs," I said. "But a shot of that moonshine and a beer chaser would be great."
"Coming right up,"
he said, and in less than a minute, the whiskey was warming my esophagus and stomach. I took a long pull off the beer and took another drink out of the mason jar James had set in front of me. I drained what was left of the beer and asked for another. I hit the whiskey one more time. Chased it.
Rough day?
James asked.
You wouldn't believe, I said.
I took another swallow of the beer, waited for about a minute, and looked across the table at him. Do you remember what you said to me when we were standing in the courthouse parking lot after the jury acquitted you of cutting that guy up?
I probably said a lot of things, he said. Mostly thank you, and thank you.
You said if I ever needed anything, anything at all, that I should come to you. James turned up the beer he was drinking, drained it, and slapped it down on the table.
And by God, here you are,
he said, wiping his mouth with the back of his arm.
Here I am.
What do you need?
He said.
What can old James Tipton Jr. do for Darren Street attorney at law?
I wrapped both hands around the beer in front of me and leaned forward on my elbows. My eyes locked onto his, and I said, I need a man killed. I need it done immediately, and I'm willing to pay you $50,000 in cash. Chapter 10. When I got back to the chalet after leaving James Tipton's, I was half drunk and so confused and exhausted that I felt as though I was living in a thick fog. Everything seemed to be happening in slow motion. I didn't seem to be able to comprehend anything fully. I'd driven aimlessly through the mountains around Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge for more than an hour, ignoring the ringing of my cell phone, and when I finally pulled into the driveway at the chalet, darkness had fallen. I walked in and smelled food cooking, but I couldn't identify what kind of food. My mother spoke to me from the kitchen, but she sounded like she was underwater. Finally, she walked up to me and took my face in her hands.
Darren, she said. Darren, are you drunk?
Maybe, I said.
A little.
Damn it, Darren. What were you thinking? Where have you been?
My mother's faith in God had waned over the years, and her language had turned a bit toward the salty side. She turned away from me and crossed the kitchen, returning with a steaming cup of coffee she'd poured from a pot on the counter.
Sit,
she said, pointing to a stool at a breakfast bar adjacent to the kitchen. I took the coffee and started sipping as she moved back toward the stove. We sat in silence for 5 minutes while I got the coffee down.
You cooked?
I finally said.
Sean and I went to the store. It was something to do. Are you going to answer my question?
What question?
Where have you been? Did you find the old client you were talking about?
She loaded a plate with baked chicken and mixed vegetables and sat it in front of me, but the thought of eating was repulsive. I pushed it away.
I did.
Did you find him in a bar?
No, I said. At his house. He was home.
So you went over there and drank with him?
Lighten up, I said. I just needed to calm my nerves a little. He had some moonshine, and maybe I drank a little too much. That stuff's like liquid heroin. Sneaks up on you.
Where's Sean?
Fast asleep.
Did he say anything about what's going on?
He just wanted to know why Katie isn't here. Have you talked to her?
I took my phone out of my pocket and looked at it. I'd received more than a dozen calls from clients, other lawyers, and from my secretary. But Katie wasn't among them.
No.
I tried her twice, but she didn't answer and she hasn't called. I folded my arms on the counter and laid my head down as a mild wave of nausea passed over me. Mom came around the counter and started rubbing my neck.
It's going to be all right, Darren, she said. We'll figure it out.
I think I might have done something really stupid,
I said, my head still down. I'd been regretting what I'd done at James's house since the moment I pulled out of his driveway.
What do you mean?
Mom said.
While you were gone?
Yeah. Hang on. I think I'm gonna...
I got up off the stool, hurried over to the sink, and coffee, alcohol, and bile spewed from my mouth. I retched for 5 minutes before it finally passed. About halfway into it, I felt a cool washcloth being pressed against the back of my neck. When I was finished and had wiped my face and rinsed my mouth, I leaned back against the kitchen counter.
What did you do?
Mom asked.
I can't tell you,
I said.
It could cause problems for you.
You're not making any sense at all, Darren. You leave here and tell me you're going to find an old client who might be able to help. You come back drunk and acting like you don't have a damned bit of sense. Then you toss your cookies in the kitchen sink, and now you won't tell me what's going on. I'm your mother. Spit it out.
Did I tell you Jalen Jordan paid me $50,000?
You mentioned it.
Did I tell you it was in the van? Under my seat?
I don't think you mentioned that. So?
It isn't there anymore, I said. It's gone.
Where did it go?
I gave it to the client I went to see. I gave it to James Tipton.
Why would you give him $50,000, Darren?
I looked at her and saw the realization cross her face.
You didn't,
she said. I nodded.
I know.
It was stupid.
Did you hire him, Darren?
Her voice took on a tone I rarely heard. It was a tone of incredulity. It meant the emotional dam was about to burst.
I didn't know what else to do, Mom. I'm terrified for Sean. So you went out and hired this... Who is this guy?
Tipton. His name is James Tipton.
You said he's a client. Is he a thug? A criminal? Did you give him $50,000 to commit murder? Has my son involved himself in a conspiracy to commit murder?
I dropped my eyes, no longer able to look at her. Hearing those words, hearing the fact that I'd committed a felony for which I could find myself imprisoned for the rest of my life made me ashamed of myself. I wasn't a killer or a vigilante. I was a lawyer, for God's sake. I was supposed to follow rules, not break them or make them up as I went along. What could I possibly have been thinking? My stomach began to knot again.
Shit, Mom, I said. Now what? Now what? I'll tell you what. You're going back out to your van, and you're going to drive back to this James what's-his-name's house, and you're going to tell him you were temporarily overcome by insanity, and you're going to get your money back and call this whole thing off.
But what if he... Get! She yelled, pulling me toward the door by the elbow.
Right now! Back over there and call it off! And I don't care what you think about the police, and I damn sure don't care about your law license. As soon as we get back tomorrow, you're going straight to the FBI.
Chapter 11. Silverware clinked against ceramic plates. Customers talked quietly, and waitresses barked orders to line cooks at the Waffle House on Paper Mill Drive in Knoxville. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ben Clancy sat in a corner booth and watched Special Agent Gary Dubose walk through the door and approach. Clancy smiled. He hadn't seen Dubose in a while, but the kid bore a strong resemblance to his old man, the late Knox County Sheriff Joe Dubose.
"Good to see you, General Clancy,"
Dubose said, using the title conferred on District Attorneys General by law enforcement officers.
"I appreciate you meeting me this early."
"It's good to see you too, Gary," Clancy said. "You're the spitting image of your daddy when he was a young man."
"Thank you, sir."
"I miss him," Clancy said. "He was a fine, fine man. The best sheriff this county has ever seen."
"I miss him, too. It's still hard to believe he's gone."
"He was always proud of you, I can tell you that,"
Clancy said.
"And look at you, a DEA agent. How long have you been with them now?"
"Just over 2 years."
"Time certainly does slip away."
At 30 years old, Dubose looked like he'd been carved from a block of granite. Despite the morning chill, he wore only a tight black T-shirt, black utility pants, and black boots. His face was long and angled, his hair cropped close, his eyes forest green.
"I apologize for last night,"
Clancy said after they'd received coffee and ordered breakfast.
"The phone woke me up. I'm one of those early-to-bed, early-to-rise people."
"It could have waited," Dubose said. "I just thought you'd be excited to maybe get a crack at Darren Street."
"Go over it for me," Clancy said, "and talk slowly. I'm getting old."
"About 10 months ago," Dubose said, "I was assigned to the task force that was investigating the distribution of oxycodone in Knox and Sevier counties. One of the names that kept coming up was James Tipton Jr. Actually, his entire family's name kept coming up. Everybody kept saying his grandmother is some sort of kingpin. But the word is that they've been moving a lot of oxy up here from Florida and selling it wholesale to local distributors. None of them have ever been arrested, but James is a suspect in a couple of unsolved murders over in Sevier County. And 2 years ago, he was charged with aggravated assault for cutting a guy up with a knife.
but a jury acquitted him at trial last year. Darren Street was his lawyer, and they apparently hit it off pretty well. We haven't been able to get squat on the family, but James apparently branched out on his own into Kentucky a while back. One of his sellers got popped up there, rolled on a distributor, and the guy put us on to James. We were fairly early into it. I had what I thought was some pretty solid intelligence, but no wires or anything. What we were really interested in were the suppliers in Florida, so my boss suggested I go see him and rattle his chain, see if anything happened. We'd heard he was using his own product, and you never know, right? So me and a couple of my guys paid him a surprise visit at his little trailer up in the mountains one night. I told him it was just a matter of time before we had enough to indict him, and that once we did, he was going away for at least 30 years, and we would wind up arresting his whole family. I told him that if he would be willing to work for us and give us his suppliers, we'd figure out a way to keep his jail sentence to a minimum, and maybe back off his family if they quit moving drugs. He's looking at a lot of time, though, General, and I know how you feel about making deals with those kind of people. I hope I didn't cross any lines, but I told him in exchange for a sentence reduction, he would have to give up his suppliers, work for us, and forfeit the money and property he's accumulated as a result of dealing drugs. He basically told me to go screw myself, but I could tell I scared him. So I left him my cell number and told him to call me if he changed his mind. Otherwise, I'd see him when we eventually got enough evidence together to indict him. Well, last night, around 9, I get a call from him and he wants to meet. He says it's urgent. So I drive to Strawberry Plains and meet him in this little bar, and he tells me that the lawyer who represented him on the aggravated assault just tried to hire him to kill somebody, and he wants to know if I'd be interested in cutting a deal in exchange for information on the lawyer. I tell him I might. So he goes into this bizarre story of how Darren Street came to his house and offered him $50,000 to kill a man named Jalen Jordan because Jordan had supposedly threatened to kill Street's kid. He said Street already paid him the money. Clancy dipped a piece of toast in an egg yolk, took a bite, and chased it with a cup of coffee.
Interesting, he said. It'd be nice if we had something besides the word of a suspected drug dealer or murderer to back it up.
I asked him if he had a recording of any kind, and he said he didn't. But I couldn't wait to call you, General Clancy. My dad would have given his right arm for a shot at Darren Street. Clancy nodded.
I know. Street was extremely disrespectful to him.
He motioned to the waitress for more coffee.
This could be huge, DuBose said. We catch Street in a murder conspiracy and jam up a drug dealer. Plus, from what Tipton told me, this Jalen Jordan might very well have killed those two little boys. Should we set up a meet with the FBI and put them on him?
We're already on him,
Clancy said as DuBose's chin fell.
So you knew about all this? No, no, Clancy said. You did the right thing by calling me immediately, Gary. Exactly the right thing. We knew about Jordan from an entirely independent source. We're all over him. But this with Darren Street is all new. I'll have to give some thought as to how we should deal with it. Do you know how Tipton left things with Street?
He said he agreed to do it, and that Street gave him the money. They're supposed to meet again late this morning, and Street is supposed to bring some more information about Jordan. Pictures, address, descriptions of vehicles, that kind of thing. So what do you want me to do? Do we wire Tipton ourselves and sting Street?
You guys have, what, 4 safe houses in and around the city?
Clancy said.
I'd like to talk to Tipton alone.
Right, DuBose said. We have 4. Which one you want to use?
The big one on Creekside Avenue.
Not a problem.
Go outside and call Tipton, Clancy said. I have things I have to take care of at the office this morning, but set something up as soon as possible after noon. Just me, you, and Tipton. That's it. Don't say a word to anyone else. I'll get the check.
Got it, General, DuBose said, and he slid out of the booth and headed for the door.
Chapter 12. When I went back to Tipton's trailer after the tongue-lashing my mother gave me, he wasn't home. I waited for an hour with that crazy dog barking and all those skulls staring at me, but I eventually lost my nerve and decided to come back early the next morning. I went back to the chalet, set the alarm on my phone for 5 a.m., and arrived at Tipton's around 5:45. It was still dark and still frightening, but I was relieved to see Tipton's car in the driveway. I pulled up close to the front porch and got out. The dog was terrifying. He had the heavy chain stretched out tight, and I kept glancing over there. If he broke the chain or the pole or his collar, he would be on me in about 3 seconds, and I was sure I'd be dead less than a minute later. I pounded on the door several times and yelled James's name. Finally, the porch light came on and James opened the door. He was wearing only a pair of boxer shorts, smelled strongly of beer and tobacco, and looked like death warmed over. "I'm sorry to show up so early like this," I said over the ferocious barking of the dog. "But I've changed my mind. I don't want you to do it." The look on his face was one of confusion mixed with pain. Judging by the way he looked, I could only imagine how badly his head was pounding. "I'm going to shoot that fucking dog," he muttered, and he turned away from the door as though he might really be going to get a gun. "James, wait! Don't shoot the dog, please. Just listen to me, okay? I changed my mind. I don't want you to do what I asked you to do last night. I don't want you to hurt anyone. Do you understand me?" He started rubbing his face with both hands, but soon stopped and nodded his head. "You understand?" I said. "You're not going to go back inside and forget I was here?"
"Aw, I got you, counselor. Don't kill the fuckwad child rapist. You gonna do it yourself?"
"I'll probably just hide until the police catch up to him. They'll be on to him soon."
"What about your boy? Is he gonna be okay?"
"I won't let anything happen to Sean. I'll keep him hidden."
"And the money?" He pointed over his shoulder with his thumb. "You want me to get the money?"
"Keep it," I said, "for your trouble." James nodded again.
"You want to come in and have a cup of coffee?"
"Thanks, but I'm going to head on back to Knoxville. I have some things I need to do. Go back to bed, James. I'm really sorry I bothered you with all of this." I drove back to the chalet, and Mom and I drank coffee while we waited for Sean to get out of bed. Once he was up, we packed up our vehicles, drove into Gatlinburg, and had breakfast. After that, we took Sean to the Ripley's Aquarium. We'd been to the aquarium a couple of times before. I usually loved it as much as Sean did, but I had a hard time concentrating on anything other than what I was going to do about Jalen Jordan. I knew he was out there somewhere. Was he waiting for me to make a mistake? To relax? Would he really kill my kid? After we'd gone through the aquarium, I gave Mom my credit card and told her to take Sean and check into the Hilton Hotel in Knoxville. "Entertain him for the rest of the day," I said. "I'll catch up with you later."
"What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to do what you told me to do. I'm going to talk to the FBI. I drove from Gatlinburg to the FBI office in Knoxville. On the way, I called and asked to speak to Special Agent Freeman, the agent Officer Denton told me she'd spoken to. Freeman was gruff, but he agreed to meet with me. I walked into his office around 11:30.
"What can I do for you?"
Freeman said in a businesslike tone. He had a smug half-smile on his face, the kind of my-shit-don't-stink look FBI agents are famous for.
"Have you ever heard of a man named Jalen Jordan?"
I said.
"Not sure. Should I have heard of him?"
"He came to see me Tuesday afternoon and asked me to represent him in an assault case that was filed by the Knoxville police. I talked to him for a little while and decided I didn't like him. When I told him I didn't want to represent him, he threatened my son." Freeman's expression didn't change a bit. He just sat there, looking at me.
"And?"
Freeman said. "He said he'd hate to see somebody throw my son off a cliff out by the sinks, like those other two boys that have been killed."
"So?"
"I was hoping you might do something about it."
"Like what?"
"I don't know. Whatever you can do. Put a tail on him. Keep a close eye on my son."
"Can't do it,"
Freeman said.
"Don't have the manpower to babysit."
He was acting so disinterested that I wanted to slap him to get his attention. "Listen," I said. "I know you guys have the bag that was found in Jordan's glove compartment. It contained two pairs of boys' underwear. That underwear most likely belonged to the two boys who were murdered."
"And how would you know that?"
Freeman said. "I can't say."
"Attorney-client privilege, huh?"
"Exactly."
"So you wouldn't be willing to offer any testimony that Jalen Jordan confessed to you that he committed these two murders, am I right?"
It was getting to the point where I wanted to do more than slap him. I wanted to jerk him up and punch him in the mouth. It was a privileged conversation, I said. I couldn't testify if I wanted to. Any judge would toss it in a heartbeat.
So, again, why are you here?
I'm trying to get some help for my son, I said loudly. Are you too thick to understand that?
And I just told you we aren't in the babysitting business. So the guy threatened your son. That isn't exactly a federal crime, is it? And you just told me anything Jordan might have said to you is privileged, so I don't see much point in continuing this conversation.
Have you gone through the van yet? I said. Have you sent the underwear off to the lab? Can you tell me how long it's going to be before you arrest him?
I'm not in the habit of discussing ongoing investigations with defense attorneys, Freeman said. And neither is any other FBI agent in his right mind. Listen, counselor, you apparently caught a bad break when Jordan walked through your door. But there isn't anything I or anyone else in law enforcement, to my knowledge, can do to help you right now. My best advice would be for you to take your son on a little vacation until it's safe for him to return.
A vacation? I said. Could you give me an idea as to how long this vacation would need to be?
Best guess, about 2 months. The lab is slow. And if you tell anyone I said that, I'll deny it.
2 months? I said. I've practically told you that Jalen Jordan is your murderer, and you're telling me it's going to take you 2 months to get him off the street? What if he kills another kid in the meantime? Somebody besides my kid?
Not gonna happen, Freeman said.
How can you know that?
Because I know. You'll just have to take my word for it.
But it's still going to be 2 months before he's arrested?
Give or take a week,
Freeman said.
Listen, I've already told you more than I should, and I have a lot of work to do, so if you don't mind.
I walked out of Freeman's office muttering and shaking my head. 2 months? Freeman seemed to be sure of himself when he said Jordan wouldn't harm another kid, which I took to meant they already had him under tight surveillance. But could I trust my son's life to them? Not a chance. 2 months wasn't an eternity, but it was a hell of a long time to shut down a law practice. Still, if it meant Sean would be safe, I'd figure out a way. I'd take him somewhere until Jalen Jordan was arrested and then return. It would mean uprooting him from school, from his life, but it was better than the alternative. I was certain my mother would do anything she could to help, but my wife was a different story. I reluctantly punched her number into my cell phone. Where were you last night? She said as soon as she picked up. If you'd bothered to answer my call, or if you'd bothered to try to call me, you would have known, I said. You're such a game player, Darren. I know. Game playing is my life. Listen, Katie, we really need to talk. Can you meet me somewhere? I'm busy right now. Are you working? I'm getting a pedicure. Can we just meet at home? It's important. Sean could be in real danger. Good Lord, Darren. Are you still on that? This isn't a movie, you know. You're not an actor. You're just a guy who hustles a living defending criminals. Nobody wants to hurt Sean. Maybe so, but I'm going to take him out of town for a couple of months. You can come if you want, or you can stay here, but Sean and I are leaving for a while. You're not taking my son anywhere, she said. I'm going to the house to get some of his things, I said. If you want to talk about it face to face in a rational manner, show up there in an hour. Chapter 13. Ben Clancy loathed men like James Tipton. He believed them to be inferior physically, made up of defective genetic material, as well as mentally and spiritually. A man like James Tipton had no chance of spending eternity in God's kingdom. He was incapable of any sort of meaningful self-examination, which meant he could never truly repent, which meant he could never be forgiven. Clancy might be willing to minimize or even ignore some of Tipton's earthly transgressions in order to get a long-awaited and well-deserved shot at Darren Street, but Tipton, in the long run, was doomed to hellfire and torment. When Clancy sent such men and women to rot in the federal penitentiary scattered across the United States, he felt not a breath of guilt or remorse. In fact, Clancy walked away from every conviction, whether it be by a guilty plea or a jury's guilty verdict, with a sense of satisfaction and an unshakable belief that justice had been served, because Ben Clancy regarded himself as an instrument of God, a David in a world haunted by Philistines. He spoke fondly and often of being a dispenser of God's justice during the Sunday school lessons he taught at Calvary Baptist Church in downtown Knoxville, and tried to instill a sense of the avenging angel into the Boy Scout troops he counseled each year at camps in and around the city. Clancy watched warily from a block away as Special Agent Gary DuBose and James Tipton walked into the safe house on Creekside Avenue in Knoxville. He'd arrived early and parked his car four blocks away, then walked around the outside of the safe house and checked out the neighborhood. DuBose and Tipton were standing just inside the front door as Clancy approached.
"I'd like to speak to Mr. Tipton alone," Clancy said.
He avoided Tipton. He had no desire to shake his greasy hand. Tipton was wearing jeans, running shoes, and a tan western-cut shirt. Clancy thought he looked like a pimp.
"We'll talk in the backyard,"